Welcome to Modern Church History. I'm Teresa Holman. With me is Father Michael Witt. Welcome, Father.
Thank you, Teresa.
We're in show number 74.
Oh, okay.
Can you believe that?
Okay.
That's moving right along.
Yeah.
And what's this week's program?
Well, we've been doing a lot of talk about the Middle East
and
the historical background behind it. This time around, we're going to be looking at the Vatican's role in all of this. Very much involved in the developments in the Middle East. And so we want to take a look at that. Before we start that, I have one more book I'd like to bring to everyone's attention. And once again, I have the audio version in front of me. This is by Caleb Carr. And the title of it is The Lessons of Terror, A History of Warfare Against Civilians, Why It Has Always Failed and Why It Will Fail Again. That's a rather hopeful subtitle on the book. I don't necessarily endorse the book itself. There's a lot of, he's not a historian, I believe he's a journalist, and there are some difficulties I have with some of his interpretations of history. He's really messed up when it comes to talking about the Crusades and a number of other things like that. But nonetheless, I think it's a provocative book on terrorism and how terrorism needs to be fought, and how ultimately terrorism never succeeds. Historically, he points that out. Anyway, it's another good book for us to think about. It's provocative, let's say. When we look at the Vatican and we look at its engagement in the Middle East in the modern era, let's say the last 200 years or so, the Vatican has two parts to its foreign policy, to its policy toward the Middle East. And one part is toward the protection of the holy places, and to make sure that there is access for pilgrims. This has always been a great concern for the Vatican. Of course, like you said before, you can always go back to the Crusades, and there's been always a concern that those holy places can be visited and pilgrims can make their way there safely. That was the whole object behind the Crusades, at least the earlier ones. And so in modern times also, the Vatican has sought for ways to do that. And in every case, of course, the Vatican doesn't have the military might in order to pull that off, and so it usually fulfills this aspect of its foreign policy by persuading and cajoling others to do that. Now, the other side of this, and this is still the first part of that foreign policy, is to do what it can then to bring peace and stability to the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, the second part of the foreign policy of the Vatican throughout the modern era has been toward the protection of the religious and civil liberties of the indigenous peoples. And of great concern has always been the Christian Arabs. And sometimes we forget that there were many Christian Arabs living in the Middle East. Well, we'll see how that much of that changed after 1948. But up until that time, that's a very large concern. And once again, in order to bring about that foreign policy, it had to rely on friendly powers that would be able to do this. Most particularly in modern history, the Vatican has relied on France to be able to bring that about. At other times, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, sometimes Spain, sometimes Italy itself, and also from time to time Russia. Interestingly enough, we haven't talked much about Vatican-Turkish relations since the Battle of Lepanto, but a lot has changed. And as you get into the 19th and 20th century, the Vatican also developed very good ties with Istanbul, and this became a bulwark of stability in the Middle East. Now, a lot of Palestinians were not real happy about the Turks occupying their land and controlling their destiny, but the Turks did maintain a semblance of peace and stability in the region, and that, of course, all changes during the First World War. To give you sort of a sense of this, the day that the British took Jerusalem, this was in December of 1917, Cardinal Gasparri, remember the foreign secretary of state for the Vatican, was meeting with a French diplomat, an attaché, and he said the following, this is a direct quote, he said, "The Turks were still the most equitable guardians of the holy places."
Wow.
Isn't that an interesting point?
Yeah.
You know, because remember, there's always this struggle that goes on over who's going to have the key for the Church of the Holy Sepulchre and all that kind of stuff. And it's the Turks actually were very, very good about balancing all of that off. I guess maybe being a neutral party or something helps. It's really in the 19th century with Pius the Ninth that you have a Vatican engagement in the Middle East. In a real sense, there are lots of Roman Catholic activity taking place under that long pontificate of Pius the Ninth in the mid-19th century, both on the area of ecclesial church actions and then also philanthropic. Mm-hmm. Now, the church is not wealthy, certainly. In the 19th century, the Vatican was always begging from hand to mouth. And then, of course, also with the loss of the Papal States itself, was even in more dire need. But regardless of this, Pius IX saw to it that in the Middle East, philanthropic activities under Vatican leadership took place. In 1847, he reestablished the Latin Patriarchate in the Middle East, in order to have closer relations to the other uniate churches, mm-hmm. Okay, these being the Greek, the Syrian, the Chaldean, and the Maronites. There was a real push on the part of Pius IX toward making sure that Christian Arabs received good educations. And religious orders begin doing this. In fact, there are seminaries in Rome that are specifically set aside by Pius the Ninth in order to make sure that the clergy in these rites would be educated. As a result of this, when you go into the 20th century, the early 20th century, as you look at Palestine itself, there is a disproportionate number of Christian Arabs in the professions. These are doctors, teachers, lawyers, professionals of various kinds. And when you look at the makeup, at the sociological makeup of Palestine in the early 20th century, what you have now is a very interesting mix. Basically three groups of people: the indigenous Jewish population, who had been there throughout the centuries, the indigenous Arab population. And there are two groups of Arabs: Arab Christians, Arab Muslims. Mm-hmm. Now, basically, the professional levels among the indigenous populations — we're not talking about the French or British or whoever is coming in, but the indigenous population — the Jewish population in Palestine tended to be more professional and more owners of businesses and shops and things of that nature. Mm-hmm. Now, as we go into the 20th century, Christian Arabs will also take that role. So there's a competition that takes place between Christian Arabs and Jewish Palestinians, or Palestinian Jews, I guess you should say. And then you've got the other large group, which is basically the Muslims, Muslim Arabs, who are shepherds and keepers of orchards and vineyards and olive dressers and that. So in other words, they're more of a day laborer mm-hmm. class of people. But those are the three. And in the 20th century, the beginning of the 20th century, there's a competition between Christian Arabs and Palestinian Jews that comes about because of the increased education of the Arab Christians. Generally speaking, as you go into the 20th century, the Vatican was unfavorable to the Zionist movement. Okay. By and large, the Vatican was pretty happy. As you go into the 20th century, the Vatican was pretty happy with the status quo in the Middle East. Things are pretty peaceful. You know, pilgrims can make their way. The holy sites are secure. Generally speaking, they're pretty happy with it. They're very fearful that this large influx of Zionists into Palestine is going to cause disruption. It's going to possibly disrupt the rights of the indigenous population, and certainly Christian Arabs are the focus of the Vatican in that, not the sole focus, but one of the focuses. And then also a real concern for the holy sites themselves, that they could be damaged or destroyed. These are irreplaceable.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
You know, it's not Disneyland. Mm-hmm. These are irreplaceable. This is where it happened.
Mm-hmm.
And for anyone to doubt the Vatican's wisdom on that, I would just recommend that they go back to their newspapers and their video clips and remember the Siege of Bethlehem back in 2003, in which the
right.
church was
locked in.
The whole group of Palestinians were locked in there. There was terrible firefights that went on, and there were a lot of innocent people who were killed in the crossfire in that, and even a fire had broken out in there. I think the church has been restored since then, but terrible damage had been done to it. So it just goes to show, you know, the Vatican back in the early 20th century realized that things could happen, and they did. In the 1920s, it becomes more and more obvious, though, in the Vatican itself, that its foreign policy vis-a-vis the increase of Zionist population in Palestine was not winning out. Basically, the Vatican was rather isolated in defending Arab rights, because honestly, nobody else was. We've already seen the way the British treated them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so while the Vatican is standing there still trying to defend Arab rights, it's pretty much speaking alone. The same thing is also true with resisting Zionist ambitions to fill Palestine with Jewish settlers. In 1922, Cardinal Gasparri sent a memorandum to the League of Nations, and he was very critical of the Balfour Declaration. And he said the following, and remember, the Balfour Declaration is the British declaration that Palestine should be open to Jewish settlement. And he said the following, and said, if the declaration is implemented, which, of course, it was underway and the League of Nations was allowing this to happen, he said this, it would establish an absolute economic, administrative, and political preponderance of Jews over other nationalities. This is what he believed would eventually take place in Palestine, then to the detriment of the others who were living in that country and had been there for many centuries. At the same time, the Vatican is also encouraging moderate Muslims, and this is something we see time and again in as a counter to the increase of Zionism, the fear that this is going to cause violence and the disruption of civil rights and personal rights. And so the counterbalance to that then is to encourage moderate Muslim leaders. So, for instance, in 1934, Pope Pius XI awarded a papal gold medal. Those are not given out very often. And he awarded it to King Abdullah of the Transjordan. I don't recall a Muslim leader receiving a papal medal in any other case.
Wow.
You know. There are, but when you come to the Second World War and the days after the Second World War, that period between 1945 and 1948, when Israel is in the process of being born, Vatican foreign policy has to shift. For two reasons. First of all, the tremendous dimensions of the Holocaust become obvious. We knew that, well, we've gone all over this already. We knew that things were happening in the East. The full dimensions of it now are finally revealed, and everyone is overwhelmed by this attempted genocide, and including obviously, Pius XII and the Vatican Foreign Service. So it becomes important for the Vatican then to rethink its position on what should happen with Jews throughout the world. There is an aspiration that Jews have toward having their own state. There is a very solid argument that Jews throughout the world could make that nobody came to their defense, and that therefore they have to defend themselves. And you have to do that through a sovereign state. And so the quandary that the Vatican has is, as it's maintained itself as a pro-Palestinian voice, does that mean now that it's an anti-Semitic voice?
Right.
Now, of course, the Vatican would always argue, of course not. And in fact, the activities of the Vatican throughout the Second World War to ameliorate the suffering of European Jews is a clear example of that. But after 1945, to speak positively about Palestinians is to imply negatively about the Jews. There's another little semantic quandary here also, because the term Semitic itself includes both Arabs and Jews.
Mm-hmm.
Both are Semites.
Mm-hmm.
So that's important to keep in mind. But so that's a quandary. That's one thing that the Vatican finds itself dealing with. The second is tremendous pressure on the part, especially of the United States, toward the establishment of an Israeli state. And so those two things operating have to cause then a rethinking. Then you have, of course, the 1948 war. And as a result, the incredible displacement of Palestinian Arabs. Now, here's the interesting thing also, that as so many of those Palestinians then were displaced, were fled from their lands, and we've talked about this before, so many of them ended up in refugee camps in South Lebanon, in Syria, and certainly in Jordan, huge numbers in Jordan, some in Egypt, in Gaza, in other Arab states, Saudi Arabia and others. Many of them made their way to the United States, and these are Christian Arabs. This is an interesting statistic that a lot of people are not aware of, but 75% of all Arab Christians left after the 48 war. 75% of all Arab Christians in Palestine left. This has, and I mentioned before also that here in the United States, the vast, vast, vast majority of Arab Americans are Christian, like 104,000 out of 107,000. I guess I'm going back to an earlier census, probably the 1990 census or 2000 census, but probably 1990 census. But you get a sense of the shift of populations, and it's the Arab Christians that are affected most heavily. Now these are the professionals, and now what they're doing is they're going to other countries where they can live out their professions and educate their children and have decent lives. So they'll be coming to the United States and to Europe and other places like that. It's the Arab Muslims, the Palestinian Muslims, who are not able to have that opportunity, they're the ones that will end up occupying these camps. They're the ones that will be living in these camps and living their entire lives in these camps. These camps were not established with the intention of being holding centers for people for the rest of their lives. That's where you have frustration and hopelessness born. And this is the theme. I've been saying this all along, as long as we've been talking about this, that the only way you solve this is through hope, not hopelessness.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what you have. Now, what ends up happening after 1948 is then you end up with eliminating professional competition. Okay, so now you end up with what had been Palestine, now is Palestine/Israel, with two groups of people instead of three. Before, we talked about the Palestinians being Arab Christians and Arab Muslims, and then indigenous Jews added to that, newly arrived Jews in the 20th century, the Zionists. So four, in a sense. Now you eliminated one of those groups, which is the Christian Arabs. And for a while, that's going to also eliminate the most vocal Arab opposition to Zionism. These are the Arab Christians are also the politicians,
mm-hmm.
Bureaucrats of that area. Now they're gone. What happens then after 1948 is an influx of aid. Otherwise, I mean, these people they had nothing. The Arabs who remained, and many of these are going to be Catholic institutions that will be coming in. The Vatican is going to be there first. So in those refugee camps, immediately after the war, immediately as these people flee and they're living literally in tent cities, the very first food they're going to be getting, tents, all the other things you need just for absolute survival, actually will be coming from the Vatican, from Roman Catholic institutions to aid the refugees. After that, then the United Nations will be coming in. Then you've got Protestant groups that will be coming in to help, and then also non-governmental organizations, the famous NGOs, will be coming in also, Red Cross and others. But for a significant period of time, it was the Catholic Church that provided the largest amount of refugee aid to the Palestinians. And these
That's
are going to be
not a surprise to me.
No, it isn't. And
they always come to the rescue.
Yeah, but keep in mind too that these are Palestinian Arabs.
Right.
Muslims.
Right, Muslim Arabs.
These would be Muslims.
Christians had left.
Right. Mm-hmm. Now, not all Christians, of course, had left. 25% stayed behind, which is a story in and of itself. Pope John the 23rd particularly wanted to address the needs of the Palestinian Arabs who remained in Israel and established then the University of Bethlehem in order to give them the possibilities of higher education. This was just terrible. I mean, from the Palestinian point of view, after 1948, the chances of them getting anything more than a primary education were just dashed unless they left Palestine and studied in Europe or in the United States. Well, that's not easy. That's expensive. You know, under any circumstances. So with the establishment of the University of Bethlehem, he then is able to address that so that Palestinians are able to once again get into the ranks of the university. This was done under the leadership of the Brothers of the Christian Schools, the Christian Brothers, and several other orders came in also and from time to time helped to supply faculty. Even to this day, the university is still very much there. The faculty is made up of Roman Catholic religious and laity. The Christian Brothers still have a significant position there. Many of the faculty now are lay people, and many of them are Muslim.
Oh, really?
Yeah, there's a number of Muslims on that faculty, too. The university is closed down almost as much as it's open. It is a very contentious thing. The Israelis have not been terribly supportive, as one might imagine. In fact, in the siege of Bethlehem in 2003, there were stories that many of us received through emails that were just shocking. The day the siege began, that night, the Israelis took over buildings that commanded a presence around the shrine itself, and in one case, I was told of the brothers' community was awakened in the middle of the night by Israeli commandos who literally broke the door down and herded the brothers into one room. They got them out of their sleep and put. This is a year and a half ago. This is an ancient history. This is a year and a half ago. Herded them into one room and then held them there for several days. And in the roundup, one brother was actually shot at. This is terrible stuff. The sexton of the shrine itself was gunned down as he was going to work one morning by an Israeli sniper. These are just terrible things that happen, and so it's very difficult even to this day. But it's also incredibly important to maintain that presence. This university is not set up only for Arab Christians, but also Arab Muslims. A glimmer of hope. Mm-hmm. There's that four-letter word again. Mm-hmm. Yeah. After 1967 and the Israeli victory again, so that, you know, after victory after victory, the Vatican, finally it becomes inevitable that something had to be recognized. And so finally, after the 67 war, the Vatican recognized the Israeli occupation of the holy places and that they would be under their control from now on. there is an improvement in dialogue between the Vatican and Israel. It's a long history, and it's not necessarily entirely pleasant, because the fact of the matter is that both entities have very different goals in mind. The Vatican continues to have the two goals of protecting the holy places and protecting the civil and human rights of all peoples in that area. With the coming of Pope John Paul II, there is again continued improvement in relations. In April of 1986, the historic visit of the Pope to the synagogue in Rome. Informal contacts between the Vatican and Tel Aviv, particularly around the establishment of the Pontifical Commission on Justice and Peace. As early as 1983, a statement comes from that Pontifical Commission in which it encourages everyone to accept Israel's right to exist, Israel's right to secure borders, and all the other rights that any other sovereign nation should have. There is, that's part of the rub also, is that there are entities within the Muslim world that deny the very existence of Israel.
Right.
And so Israel is fighting for its very life. I mean, Israelis are fighting for their lives. And either because of wars, attacks on their country, or because of terrorist acts. Mm-hmm. And so the Vatican recognizes their right to do this. There's even a friendly visit by the Prime Minister in 1985. This was Shimon Peres, visited the Vatican and had conversations with Pope John Paul II. These were private conversations, but afterwards a spokesman for the Vatican admitted that there were, and this is their own words, there were divergences of viewpoints on the essential problems. Mm. That's a diplomatic way of saying that they didn't agree on a lot of things. And undoubtedly, the single most important is the question of the Palestinians themselves and the way that they're treated. In 1984, Redemptionis Anno, a quote from that document, gives again a glimmer of the Vatican's concern for the Palestinians themselves. Let me read you just a sentence or so. It says the following. It says, "The Palestinian people who find their historic roots in Palestine and who for decades have been dispersed have the national right in justice to find once more a homeland and to be able to live in peace and tranquility with the other peoples of the area." So here, the Vatican is talking about all of those peoples who have been dispersed. These are Palestinians. John Paul is talking about those Palestinian Muslims who are in camps. Mm-hmm. This is in 1984. These people went to those camps in 1948.
Wow.
That's 1984. They're still there.
Whole life.
2004.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, whole life, an entire mm-hmm. generation. Mm-hmm. Now it's second generation. Mm-hmm. And so he's speaking to them. He's speaking to Arab Christians who have now found homelands in other areas if they want to come back. This is something that in the negotiations between Palestinians and Israelis is referred to as the right of return. And that's a very contentious issue, because the fact of the matter is that if there's a recognition of the right to return and Palestinians then begin moving back to the areas that they had left, but in many cases now these are going to be the children mm-hmm. of those who had left, or even the grandchildren of those who left, the population demographics is such that Israel would be overwhelmed mm-hmm. by Palestinians. And if Israel is going to maintain itself as a democracy, it would reflect it in the demographic makeup. Israel would then become, for all practical purposes, a Palestinian country.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have seen in recent years how that can happen and happen peacefully. South Africa is an example of that, where the apartheid regime was dismantled and a black majority was able to take over the country without the kind of genocide that could have happened The question is whether this is possible right. in Israel. The alternative is what's called a two-state solution. That is to say, a Palestinian state that is set up as its own country and then an Israeli state set up as its own country, the two of them living side by side as neighbors. That's the position of the United States currently, as well as Israel favors that too. The chief goal of Pope John Paul II has been besides the two goals that have always been part of the Vatican policy, holy places and the rights of the indigenous populations, another goal of his within those has been the preservation of Palestinian Christians, those who are still there, the protection of their rights. And he recognizes the importance of that population staying in the Holy Land, whether it be in Palestine or in Israel. And because otherwise his concern is that the shrines themselves simply become historic monuments,
right.
which no one, you know, as right now they're a living entity. If you were to go to Nazareth, you would meet people who are descendants of the Nazareans,
wow.
you know, from the time of Jesus. Bethlehem, you know, the same way. The Arab Christians who are there have been there from the time of Christ and shortly after. And so there's this historic continuity. It is a living reality. Withdraw the people, and there's no living reality there anymore. As I say, it simply becomes a monument to visit instead. And so these living communities need to be protected. And John Paul II has been very concerned about that, interested in that. Much of his foreign policy is in that region has been centered on that. Again, you might remember it was two Christmases ago, there were visits to many, many churches here in St. Louis of Palestinian Christians who came from Palestine itself through connections that they had with Palestinian Americans. And remember that they were going to many of these churches and they were selling beautiful hand-carved wood statues and nativity scenes and those things. And the reason why they did that was because they came to us because we're not going to them anymore. And it's they're trying the best they can to eke out a living in order to stay there. This is all part and parcel of what we're talking about. Talking about living history.
Right,
you know?
Right.
And it was right in our church halls.
It was,
just 2 years ago.
And I saw them even in some of the stores. I saw in malls I saw them set up.
That's right. Yeah, I'd forgotten about that. That's right. A second goal that he has, too, is an act of solidarity with suppressed minorities all throughout the Third World. His solidarity, standing in solidarity with the Palestinians and their suffering, is a sign of solidarity with others also who are suffering. I'd give you one. I mean, we have to always keep this in context that the Israelis are doing what they're doing because of security concerns.
Mm-hmm.
But when the rubber hits the pavement, then you have individual acts that are just infuriating. And an example of this is of a Palestinian, I don't remember whether he's Christian or Muslim, it doesn't make any difference in this case, but he suffered a heart attack. He was a man in his 60s, suffered a heart attack. I remember reading about this, and I believe it was in Christianity Today, in one of the articles last year. His son recognized that the little clinic that they had on the Palestinian side could not take care of him. There was a wonderful Israeli hospital just one checkpoint away. And so he rushed him to this hospital, got as far as the checkpoint, and at that point the Israeli soldiers who were in charge of that checkpoint obviously saw this Palestinian man in the midst of a heart attack and yet would not let him go to the hospital, would not call the hospital to bring help to him, an ambulance or whatever, but held him at that checkpoint until the son left him there, went back home, and got the paperwork that they had not gathered enough because they were trying to get to the hospital. And so he arrived at the hospital something like 45 minutes or an hour late, And I don't know what the results were, whether he died after this or whether he survived it. But, you know, anyone having a heart attack, you don't want to delay him for 45 minutes to an hour. Every minute, yeah. And this is a common day-to-day experience. Now we have this huge wall that's put up,
which
has to be an affront. Balancing this off with Israeli concerns for security, but the other side of it from the Palestinian point of view, you know, what can you say? There's a third item also that that concerns the Pope in these relations, and that is a continued dialogue with world Islam. We are not enemies. We have to continually remember that. There's so much in the news that shows terrible atrocities taking place when Muslims and Christians are associated together. You've got all the news coming out of Nigeria and the Sudan, you know, a couple years ago, East Timor, Pakistan, in which but keep in mind also that Shiite mosques are being bombed and people being killed just as much as in Christian churches in Pakistan. Iraq, just last week, a Christian church in downtown Baghdad was firebombed. So there are lots and lots of examples throughout the world in which it's obvious that Christians and Muslims are fire and water, you know, water and oil. But there are other areas in which there is tremendous cooperation. First of all, throughout the world, Muslims, both Shiite and Sunni, are very pro-life. And in Cairo, if you remember a number of years back, when the United Nations tried to do its little deal on making abortions easy and available to everybody in the world, it was Muslim states and the Vatican that was able to outmaneuver, unfortunately, countries like the United States and some of our Western so-called Christian countries. Mm-hmm. So we have that. The same thing is also true, although I think our theologies are different, our anthropologies are different concerning birth control.
Mm-hmm.
And again, a different approach, different understanding, but the same objective, that looking for natural family planning is the way to do this with respect to the to everyone involved. And then also family values. You know, Muslims are just as upset over this whole question of gay marriages, mm-hmm. as any Christian should be. So there's so much in common, and the Pope understands that. And he is really also very popular. I mean, I'm thinking in terms of his trip to Syria a couple years ago, his trip to I believe it was Morocco a couple years ago, for a Muslim youth council or youth gathering, and he was greeted by these Muslim youth like as if he was a rock star.
Wow.
You know, not just, you know, the World Youth Days with Christians, but also these Muslims. So he really speaks to them, and so that's another important aspect that we keep in mind in all of this. However, Israel has two very powerful cards as they play this game. And one is they have military supremacy, and that's all there is to it. There is no combination of Arab unity that could contest on the battlefield Israel's military supremacy. First of all, as we've seen already, the Arabs can't do it because they can't get their act together and unite. And even if they did, they still wouldn't be able to. It's commonly assumed now, and I'm sure there's... Well, it's commonly assumed that Israel has a nuclear bomb, and one would also assume that they wouldn't hesitate to use it if it looked as though Arab military superiority was about to become a reality. That's not a reality, and it's something that Israel maintains its military superiority. From the Israeli point of view, they have to do that because the day that they let their guard down is the day they all die.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a very firm conviction on that, and they're probably not too far off from the truth.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, the other second very powerful card that Israel has is its relationship with the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And all of this becomes so poignant in Lebanon itself. I'd like to talk a little bit about what happened in Lebanon in the 1970s and 1980s. Because here you have coming together all of the various elements in a in the one part of the Middle East that still had a very strong Christian base. Okay. And basically we're talking about the 1975 Lebanese War. Here, as I say, Christians are very actively involved. These are Maronite Christians. The landscape is difficult. I'm not talking about the physical landscape. Lebanon, from what I understand, is a beautiful country, just absolutely gorgeous. And Beirut is a beautiful city itself, and the beaches and everything else. It's unfortunately, it's war torn and strife torn. To the east of Lebanon, the Lebanese have been cursed with being close to the Syrians, and the Syrians are dominated by a despot who is a Ba'athist, much like Saddam was a Ba'athist. The Syrian leadership is also Ba'athist, so there's a certain socialist orientation to them. Okay. To the south of Lebanon is is Israel, and so they're caught in some pretty tough neighborhood. Mm-hmm. Added to that, Lebanon itself is not homogeneous. You have Muslims in Lebanon, and there are three flavors of Muslims, all located in Lebanon: Sunnis, Shiites, and also Druze. And then you have Christians. And the Christians are, by and large, Maronite. But in the 1970s, even these groups fell into two categories. There were those who supported a rather charismatic general by the name of Bashir Gamayel. And he's a Maronite Christian. He's a member of the Falangist Party. And as I say, the organized military supported him. The president, however, was also a Maronite. This is Suleiman Frangi. I'd have to check that out to make sure that he's Maronite. With a name like Suleiman, doesn't sound right. Let me check that out. But anyway, he was the president of Lebanon, and he's supported by militias. And so there's a lot of difficulties within Lebanon itself. And all of these want unconditional backing from the Vatican. Well, in March of 1980, the Vatican sends Cardinal Casaroli, Agostino Casaroli, to Beirut to meet with the various elements. And he suggests that the Vatican would do what it could and would use its influence with the other powers of the area to defend Lebanon's territorial integrity, okay, and identity as an independent country, because from time to time it's subsumed into Syria. Mm-hmm. Okay, so they want to defend Lebanon's integrity as a country and its identity. But at the same time, Cardinal Casaroli tells the Lebanese who are gathered there that it's the Vatican's interest to protect all peoples in that region, including Muslims. This was not terribly well received. This is a quote, I believe, from from Gamayel, and he said the following. He said the Vatican, quote, should understand that Christians in Lebanon are not guinea pigs for the Christian Islamic dialogue in the world. Mm-hmm. So what they're looking at is they're looking at one of the foreign objectives, one of the overarching objectives of Pope John Paul II, of a dialogue between Christians and Muslims, and they're believing that the Vatican is using Lebanon in order to advance that dialogue, but that the Lebanese Christians would be the would pay the price for that, and they're looking at it from that point of view. Well, the fact of the matter is that the civil war spun out of control, and things got worse and worse. By the summer of 1982, Israel saw total instability north of its border, and so invaded Lebanon. The Vatican immediately called for a ceasefire for all sides. It was absolutely ignored by all sides. And then things spun out of control and got even worse. In 1983, there was a massacre of Druze Muslims. That was followed by another massacre in two different camps. These are Palestinian camps. The camps are known as Sabra and Shatila, and they're significant. Even to this day, those two names, Sabra and Shatila, will rankle Palestinians. Because what happened was, these are Palestinian camps. These are the camps that is, two camps that had been there since 1948. What happened was that a group of out-of-control Christian militia, this phalangist militia, broke into those camps and went through and slaughtered people, Palestinian Muslims. And standing outside the camps were Israeli military forces that allowed this to take place. They could have stopped it. Now, either they allowed it to take place or they directed it to take place. We don't really know for sure. Depends on whose side of the story you want to hear. But the commanding general of that Israeli force, ready? Ariel Sharon, the present president of Israel. So you can see that, that, you know, once again, current names have long histories. And to the Palestinians, he is to this day referred to as the butcher of Sabra and Shatila. What finally brings this bloodbath to an end is a multinational force that's sent in. And it's going to be made up of Americans, French, Italians, and British. And they're going to come in and impose law and order on all sides. That works until 1984. And in 1984, if you might recall, there was a terrible bombing, a suicide bombing of the U.S. Marine barracks near the airport. And over 200 American Marines were killed. It's one of the worst disasters in Marine history. One of the things we don't really pay much attention to is that on that same day, just an hour or so prior to the Americans being destroyed, that American barracks being destroyed, the French were also bombed by a suicide bomber. And many Frenchmen, I would guess a couple dozen French soldiers were also killed in this. We're not really sure who sponsored this. We believe the Hezbollah had something to do with this, or maybe were the force that did this. There is a link. I've read of a link to Iran that links back to this. And if so, that makes a lot of sense. Because in the 1980s, oh, by the way, I should mention also that the United States withdrew from Lebanon after that, and the rest of the international force, the multinational force, also withdrew, and with that, Lebanon fell into chaos again until the Syrians finally marched in and took over. That's another important lesson for the terrorists that they learned, is if you can inflict a horrible casualty on the Americans, they'll run. You know. Anyway, let's take a look at this whole Iranian situation. At the time, Iran was controlled by the Ayatollah Khomeini. We'll talk about it a little bit later on. He was at war with Iraq, and specifically with Saddam Hussein. These two powers had been slugging it out with each other using World War I tactics, basically sending huge numbers, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of men, just throwing them at each other, and using weapons that we had not seen since World War I, gas, mustard gas. I mean, you know, these kinds of weapons of mass destruction, and both sides were using them. The Iranians were using Syria as an ally in order to try to spread radical Islamic revolution, the kind that you saw in the Iranian Revolution, against moderate Muslims. And so the Iranians play a role in this because they, in Lebanon, they have then this little proxy war that takes place. Lebanon, of course, being on the western side of Iraq. And so there's this little proxy war that takes place in Lebanon, and in the end, it really becomes a question of survival of the Lebanese people as they're being used by both sides. When we come back next time around, we're going to take a more specific look at, I guess we could call it, the post-barracks Lebanon. After the multinational force, the last sign of hope withdraws, and we'll take a look at how the Lebanese try to survive, how Pope John Paul II tries to intervene on their behalf, and not only him, but also a number of important American bishops to try to bring about some kind of peace. After we look at that, then we're going to look more specifically at Israeli relations with the Vatican and the eventual establishment of diplomatic relations. So, there we have it. The Vatican is engaged and doing what it can in the area, but its power is mainly based in moral certitude, not in military might.
All right. Well, okay. Shall we close today with a prayer?
Sure. Glory be to the Father, to the Son, and to the Holy Spirit.
As it was in the beginning,
is now, and ever shall be, a world without end. Amen. May Almighty God bless you in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit.
Amen. Thank you, Father.
Okay.